All right, welcome, guys. Today's podcast is going to be different. So I'm with Henry Lee from Watchmaking Project, and we're going to try a new podcast episode out. What do you think, Henry?
Hey, Anthony. Thanks for having me on. And yeah, I'm excited to see what you and your viewers have in store for me.
So, I mean, in the beginning, it's going to be, it's brand new. So we're just going to hash out as much as we can. I'm sure there's going to be some hiccups along the way and we'll adjust, but I mean, this is something new, especially in this unprecedented time of the COVID, you know, we're going to be doing things a little differently. So I put out a ask me anything kind of question on Instagram and Facebook for people to submit their questions. And, we got a bunch in, and, the point of this podcast is essentially to, be as conversational as possible. And non-politically correct, as regular and layman as possible as well, while keeping it lighthearted and just having fun.
Okay.
Sounds cool?
Sounds cool. Normally, I am I'm 4 or 5 drinks in when I chat with you. So today hopefully, we'll solve some world well, issues.
Who said you can't drink now? But anyway, so there are a couple questions in. There are a couple serious and a couple interesting ones. Do you want to start with the funny ones first, or do you want to start with like the educational ones first?
Whichever floats your boat.
All right. So one of the first questions that came in, top pet peeves in repairs.
Well, all right. So the number one peeve I have is when you open up a case back and some monkey decides to initial into the case back, scratch the job number and their name into the case back or the movement. I've had times where they've initialed the movement with like a broken oiler or something. And it's cringeworthy.
That's your top pet peeve?
That's one of my pet peeves when I open up the watch and you see like unprofessionalism by the previous person who toyed with the watch.
That's also one of my pet peeves, and I put that out there on Instagram, and a lot of people hit me back up with like telling me that Rolex and other brands do that. So I mean, they apparently still do that to this day. And what are your thoughts on that?
No, listen, they do it with a marker, right? Like they do it with like a little, like a fine point marker where they kind of initial a job number and then maybe their name, which if I get like an alcohol based solution, I can rub off the job number, you know what I mean? But I'm talking about watchmakers who like scratch on the job number and their initials into the case back, or almost like engrave the back of the case back or and the movement with their own.
Well, I think
insignia.
Rolex uses like a script. No, don't. I'm pretty sure they use like a sharp, kind of like a tungsten carbide type material where it kind of etches into any type of material. I thought they used markers too, because that's how they originally taught to begin with. But to my knowledge now, apparently they also use scribes as well.
Really, that's news to me, because when I was working for Swatch Group, you know, we did the whole marker thing, but then we would have, you know, different colors for different markers. So when you finish the job, it would be like a green marker. You throw in the job number, your initials.
Yeah, we did something similar like that too. In one of the companies I used to work for, they would put the initial for whether it was a quick service or a complete service, the repair number, and then the watchmaker's initials. But one of my points in the original post was kind of like, in this day and age, there has to be a better way for companies to actually know which repair was done by which watchmaker.
You know, I was chatting with someone a while back, a couple of industry people, of having a way for the secondhand market to know whether or not the watch was serviced. And was a service by like a reputable dealer, but then it was like it turned out to be this big, big cumbersome project that I didn't pursue any further, right? Because usually, like, when you buy the watch, buy a secondhand watch, you kind of want to know the service history, right? So the best way to do it is kind of to have a centralized location where you can log everything. Much like, you know how you do a Carfax and stuff, you type in the VIN number, and then you pull up kind of the service history of the watch. But, you know, it's kind of hard to track, and a lot of the watchmakers who service and stuff now, some people who still are doing servicing, they're not that tech-savvy. So, you know, it needs to be like a group effort as opposed to like a single person.
I think it needs to be like a standardized approach. I mean, everyone kind of has to be on the same page where all the watchmakers, I understand the concept of back in the days where, you know, that's kind of how they knew who worked on what watch and when it was last serviced. But in today's day and age, I'm sure there is a better way. If all the watchmakers got together and kind of agreed unanimously on a standardized approach to, leaving some sort of repair history.
Yeah, I could completely agree. It would help out the person. It would first, number one, create a authentication trail, right? So, you know, you type in a serial number, you know, if this was last serviced by so-and-so, you would know that it's an authentic, you know, Breitling, Omega, Rolex, because a lot of times I would get timepieces in and it's, you know, hey, I got this off of eBay or, you know, got this secondhand. I'm not sure if this is real. And I got a really good deal. So I'm not sure if this is real. Can you please authenticate?
Now, what are your thoughts? You know? I mean, so each time I bring this up, I always get like the opposing view. Like someone's always saying, you know, they think it's cool. You know, they think it's cool to have someone inscribe their initials in their case bags and leave some sort of authentic history behind the watch, and it gives it more of sentimental value to it by doing so. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
So I get the storytelling part. I get the fact that, you know, like, they open their case back and there's like, you know, four or five or maybe eight different job numbers and signatures on it. I understand that, right? Because, you know, maybe years and years ago, people kind of didn't know any better. And that's how they were taught. Because I was initially, when I first started into it, I was also taught to initial. But I never did, because I just didn't like the fact that you would deteriorate. I would leave a permanent mark on that watch, where my job, my understanding of my job was to go into it and leave that timepiece as if it were brand new, right? Or as in best condition as possible after I'm done with it, right? So the next person opens it, they can also see it reflects on my workmanship, right? So, you know, if a person who scribed their names like by accident didn't clean it up properly and there's metal shavings in the watch, well, guess what? Like you just ruined the service, like, potentially.
Now, what are your thoughts on? I know there was history. One of the reasons why Rolex actually switched over to scribing case bags was that they discovered with the permanent markers or with any type of Sharpie or some sort of markers where you would inscribe the case back with instead, the fumes from the marker itself would actually mess with the oils in the watch.
That's a little bit too into the weeds for me. You know, at that same context, you know, you should also not wear your Rolex while walking around in a carpeted floor, right? Because it creates static, you know, and you shouldn't go somewhere where it's too cold. You shouldn't go somewhere where it's too hot, because, you know, the weather affects temperature changes the timekeeping functions of the
movement. Good point. That's a good point. So, I mean, yeah, I can see that. I mean, what would you think is a better standardized approach then? If all the watchmakers were to agree on a standardized formula, would you say some sort of initial to let everyone know whether it was a quick service or complete service, a repair number, and then the watchmaker's initials? Or, I mean, what would the standardized approach you think would be?
It depends, right? Because in the U.S. alone, I believe we have maybe a little under 1,000 watchmakers, right? Worldwide, there's maybe like 5,000 or 6,000 watchmakers. First of all, there's language barriers. Once you go to, you know, Europe, you go to like India, you go to China, like, you know, everyone's full service, you know, could be complete maintenance service. It could be FS, and in French, it could be something completely different, right? So it's hard to kind of say in stone, this is what I think it should be. I think it should be kind of a group effort by all the watchmakers and horologists and, you know, kind of industry people to, like, hey, this is kind of how we would like to take, you know, secondary market. This is kind of like the
so, like, if you had every single watch brand, every single watch company, every single watch school in a meeting, what would you advise them in terms of what the standardized approach should be? Because I think, you know, some sort of information to let, if we all agreed, let's just say language barrier wasn't an issue, and then everyone was to say, all right, this is a complete service, this was a full service or a quick service, here's the repair number, and this was the watchmaker in the year that it was worked on, right? Would you agree on that?
Yeah, and then, you know, if parts were changed, or, like, if they had any findings, because in Swatch Group, we use a SAP. And then, like, you know, when I would get a comeback of another watchmaker, it would be my job to kind of dissect what went wrong. And then through my findings, I put it into SAP, like, you know, so-and-so job number, you know, these were the findings, you know, maybe screw wasn't too tight, or wrong oil was used, or, you know, dirt and debris was found. And then I would initial it, right? Then do a service.
Okay, so that's good. I think one of my pet peeves in repairs is like people butchering the movement or the parts before I even get a chance to work on it. For example, like old banking pins, if they adjusted the banking pins instead of doing their job, that screws it up for me altogether.
It's funny you say that. I have a Peter Speakmarin watch on my bench right now that no one would take on, and I was like, oh, you know, it shouldn't be that bad. And I opened up the watch, and they Swiss cheese the balance, you know, because they were trying to take out material. They snapped off the escape wheel pivots, screws are missing, and it's like the worst part is the rep in the U.S. he won't get back to me, and then secondly, the movement company Technotime is out of service or is bankrupt. It's no longer a functioning company. You know, because I reached out to Heinrich and Lockley, and I was like, hey, dude, you know, I'm sitting on a piece here. Can you help me out here? Like, you know, can you, like, poke around in the Lockley and see in Switzerland, like, where I can source, like, the movement parts? Because it's not worth me to sit there and make those parts. Because in the long run, that watch is going to run into additional issues.
Wait, you know? so you took that on without even taking a look at the watch?
So the watch itself looked decent. But yeah, I, again, obviously, like I tell everyone who gives me a watch for an estimate, like, I won't really know until I sit on the bench and get deep into the weeds, you know, because sometimes, you know, people mess little things up that maybe you can fix, or you can fix and try to repair it before,
Funny you mentioned Heinrich. I was about to say, I thought Heinrich was friends with Peter. No, last I checked, I think they work together. So,
yes.
I mean, for those who don't know, Heinrich is a friend of ours. He runs his own school in Switzerland, Heinrich Korpula. But yeah, just for those people who are listening that don't know who Heinrich is that we're talking about.
Yes, Heinrich Korpula is a dear friend of ours. He runs KHWCC in the Lochley, Switzerland. It's a very highly specialized independent watchmaking school in Switzerland. He was obviously, before he founded his school, he was a teacher at WOSEP for many years. Decided that it was a niche. Yeah.
So, I mean, look, wait, doesn't Heinrich know Peter? Like, can't Heinrich just reach out to Peter? Like, hey.
Yes. Peter Speakmarin no longer, is affiliated with the watch company. He's, him and Heinrich are working on the Naked Watchmaker, Naked Watchmaker together, which is, I believe, a visual collection of movements, beautiful movements, getting deconstructed and broken down, and, you know, getting their movements under the sun, under light, and under eyes of many watch enthusiasts.
Well, I just figured maybe, you know, Peter could help out. I guess not.
Yeah, no, I wasn't gonna. No, yeah, that's very true. You know, he did start the watch brand, but, you know, from my understanding, you know, I don't know Mr. Speakmarin personally. It's from my understanding he no longer runs the company anymore. So, or he's not involved with the company anymore. He's fully 100% like dedicated to, you know, education and advancement of, you know, letting other people know about watchmaking. Yeah.
All right. Well, that answers this question. Man, you should see some of the questions that came in. A lot of them are interesting. Another question is, okay, is it okay for high horology brands to save costs by leaving surfaces unfinished?
My opinion on that is, if you're telling the end user or the client that it's the timepiece they're receiving is, you know, is it has the Geneva stripes, it has engrage, it has sablage, it has the whole, you know, the whole nine yards of the high end finishing aspect of watchmaking, then by all means, please try to do that. If not, then you're essentially lying and swindling your clients, right? And some brands, you know, they say all this stuff, but it's a machine, you know, and as a watchmaker who works on different types of watches and finishes movements, you can tell, like, oh, this is a machine.
This is funny you mentioned that. It's kind of like when you open up a watch that's like $20,000 and the inside's really just like a $60, $70 movement.
I'm not going to drop names.
Yeah, let's not do that. We're going to get our podcast.
We're going to cease and desist. But listen, I had one, like a very high end brand, obviously, that had like maybe a $40, like $30 quartz movement inside. And I'm like, what's the price of this watch?
I think that's one of my pet peeves too. I mean, knowing the price value for some of these watches and then opening them up and seeing the insides of it, it's really disappointing.
Yeah, because so before I opened the watch, we looked at the price tag. You know, I used to get the watches in, you know, before, and then like the price tag would be there. I'm like, oh, look, I'm like, all right, there's probably a nice movement inside.
You used to feel good about it too. Like, let's say you get a watch and you're like, oh shit, this is $60,000. Yeah, I'm working on a $60,000 watch.
Yep.
Wait.
And then you'd open it up, and then it's like, oh gosh, what is this thing? This is like, this is offensive to my eyes.
All right. Okay. So I mean, I agree too. I think I think high horology brands, if you're gonna be selling that price point to clients and whatnot, leaving surfaces unfinished would be akin to selling mediocre movements. You know what I mean? What's the point of that? I mean, I completely agree with what you're saying. So.
Yeah. So like if you're telling them like, hey, this is buy the $60,000 watch just because it's affiliated with so and so like luxury brand, then fine. But if you say buy the $60,000 watch because we have all this great finishing and all this hand finishing and all this like black polishing and stuff, and then like inside it's kind of lackluster, doesn't, you know, perform up to your marketing standards, then by all means, please do not like market something that's not
actually
true,
speaking of this, what are your thoughts on buying watches for the movement and buying watches for the brand? I mean, speaking of this, I mean, it's kind of like saying, I mean, I've seen Swiss Army with like 7750 inside, and then I've seen other brands that sell for 4 or 5 times that value with 7750s inside as well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess some brands add something different to it, you know,
Are you saying they mod it?
Yeah, I mean, they mod it. Sometimes I guess that justifies, that R&D justifies
the cost. What do you think about it? Do you agree with that? I mean, do you agree with buying watches for the movement or buying it for the brand itself?
You know, I'm torn between this question because I do both, right? Like, I love the JLC brand, right? And I love the movement that JLC brand has, you know? And I love other, like, you know, like Panerai, you know? Like, you know, Panerai's not bad, right? When Panerai has their own version of 750, you know? And I used to, you know, get, when I couldn't afford higher-end brands, I had, like, a Bulova that was, like, a 750 inside. And I was so proud of the, like, $200-$300 watch because that was kind of the value of the movement, right? So, I mean, yeah.
Okay, that's good. All right, so... one thing you hate the most in watchmaking.
So that's a loaded question. It's kind of like very general.
I mean, that's a question, man. That's a question to give. They're like, what's sure. The one thing you hate the most in watchmaking? I guess it's not.
Why don't you start?
It doesn't have to be. Okay, so I'm gonna take this as general as possible. It doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, movements or in watches itself. Watchmaking, I would take watchmaking as an industry as a whole. I think one of the things I hate the most is the lack of spotlight in watchmaking, you know, the lack of education. If you look at the discrepancies between the salespeople, the service associates and the watchmakers, it's a huge difference. You know, the salespeople who are selling the watches don't even educate the clients in terms of what to expect. And then that in and of itself leads to so many problems that the service associates have to deal with, which at the end trickles down to the watchmaker. You know, like how many times have clients brought in watches saying that the watch isn't working, when in reality they never knew they needed to wind the watch. You know, and that's one of the things I hate the most. It's just the constant reiteration. It's the education. It's the lack of education. It's the lack of spotlight. It's the lack of... If there were more eyes on this specific topic, this specific situation, rather than looking at it as a whole of a luxury industry, I think watchmaking will flourish even better.
Yeah, I agree with that statement. And also, I keep on forgetting you wrote the book, right? You wrote the book, and there's chapters and pages and essays you have dedicated to reality versus expectations. So, yeah, I keep on forgetting that. But, yeah, I also, to add to that, one thing I don't like about some of that stuff is people who get too technical with things that, you know, you could explain, kind of explain in black and white, right? Okay, as a watchmaker, like, I would have sometimes, maybe they're leaving school or whatever, they just finished school, and they're trying to be as technically proficient or technically sound as professional as possible. And it's like, oh, I adjusted the end-shake, like, you know, X amount, like, you know, getting really specific. And it's like, okay, just put the watch on my bench. Like, what issue are you having trouble with? Let me feel. Like, it's just, like, that kind of is a pet peeve for me. Right. Like, and I get they're trying to speak the language, and it's like when doctors talk to doctors, that's what they say. But sometimes, like, you know, utilizing Occam's razor, the simplest way is
probably. I actually agree with that a lot. Right? I mean, but there are a couple things I do want to raise a point on. I mean, I do agree with you that a lot of watchmakers and a lot of people in the industry try to sound more technical and high-end and complicated as they possibly can, to no good reason. And then at the same time, there also has to be some sort of language agreement, you know? Like, if, for example, if I have a problem with a watch and I'm coming to you with it, I probably want to let you know, like, hey, I did adjust this X, Y, and Z, just so you kind of know what I did beforehand. But I agree that people try to make it sound way more complicated than it really is.
Yeah, it's I'm not trying to, like, when I'm trying to like fix an issue with a move, like I'm trying to like diagnose, fix a movement issue, I don't want to listen to a technical guide.
Agreed. Right?
to be honest, I like, I want to put on the microscope. I want it on my bench. I kind of want to feel and kind of see and kind of like replicate the issue that the person was facing, so that I can myself try to, you know, come up with a solution and not have to sound logical and not have to sound too technical when I explain it to them, you know. So
I agree. One thing is like sometimes some of these, speaking of like language and terminology, I mean, one of the things that, to your point, one of these things where a lot of these watch companies, they make up these names and these terminologies to make the watch sound that much more complicated and that much more enticing. Like, that's what blows my mind all the time.
Well, you have to understand, it's marketing, right? How can I spin this?
Yeah.
I mean, that's their careers, and, you know, there's industries based on, you know, selection of words and choice of usage of words for certain things so that it can appeal a potential buyer.
You're breaking up. Hello? Yeah, I can hear you.
Can you hear me now?
But awesome. Yeah, man, I agree. I agree 100%. Man, we got so many questions coming in, man. I don't know if we can finish all these in time. We might have to do like a second episode after this. All right. So I don't want to butcher this question, so I'm going to read it exactly as is, and don't hold me to it. Okay. If you had to choose, would you have a watch logo branded on your forehead, but be legendary in the watch industry for all of history, or be normal and be the laughing stock in the watch industry for the rest of history?
Be normal and be a laughing stock. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
Am I going to curse? I don't like, I'm not like, yeah. I prefer not to have my forehead branded. I'm not a fucking cattle. So I'd rather you know, laugh at me and not give me your work than to walk around, then wake up every morning looking at my forehead.
That means your kids and your kids' kids, and everyone's going to look in the history of watchmaking and look at you and know that you're the laughing cow.
Hey. You know, find another industry. I'll become a car mechanic. You know, like from fixing watches, I'll fix cars. Like, I'll be the best car fixer. I'll be the best, like, you know, restorer.
You know, I almost want to agree with you, but I don't know. Being legendary in the watch industry for the rest of history, at least you're in the history books.
Yeah, I'm not Harry Potter. Sorry, like you can get your forehead branded, dude. I'm not like I like the forehead the way it is.
Well, that's good to know. It's tough, man. I think I agree with you. I think I'll be normal and just leave the industry and just get.
No, come on, really? With a book and really a following. There's no way you do it.
It's like the way I think about it is, how many people try to be legendary in history? How many people want to have their names known? How many people want to leave an impact on the rest of the world for for even long after they're gone? Having a watch branded on your forehead might be just a minor consequence, you know?
Hey, listen, there are people who want to be Harry Potter. I'm just trying to live my good life. I'll go work at a small mall changing batteries, you know, like they'll never know like about any watch industry guys at a mall changing batteries. So I'm good with that.
That's good. I mean, I don't know, that question was interesting. And then another question that came in was to roast them. I don't know, people want to know, not you, people want to get roasted. Like, they want us to look at them on their Instagram and roast them.
Give me the Instagram and we'll roast every day.
We'll do it next. We'll do it next in the next podcast. I put that aside. But that's a good one. We should definitely try to take a look at that. We got to do it in a way where it's not well, we don't get sued or cease and desist or some shit.
Wait, yeah. The guy said roast him. How are we gonna get a cease and desist?
I don't know. People come to join watchmaking and bullshitting, and next thing you know, they're getting roasted and shit.
Yeah, but that's the bullshitting part of watchmaking. We're
bullshit. Let me save this question, and we can revisit this in the next one. Biggest change. What are your thoughts on the biggest changes in watchmaking post COVID?
Listen, everyone wasn't as this also doesn't have to relate to watchmaking, right? Because I feel like everyone is, some industries were more vulnerable than others, and obviously if you're on the after sales service side, no one was taking in watches. Like, no big name brands had their doors open. Maybe some stuff was still being sold kind of through online, but immediately the experience that VIP clients used to have, just like ceased overnight, right? I was having a discussion with a couple buddies of mine, he went from going out like 6-7 nights a week to staying home for 3 months.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a complete lifestyle change. And that shows you how fragile the situation everyone's in.
I don't know. I think, I know for a fact, during the whole COVID situation, a lot of watch companies, their e-commerce went up through the roof. It was holiday season for them every single day. So I think what COVID has actually done was introduce people who would usually never go online to buy watches to actually bridge that gap and take that first step.
Yeah, now industry companies are going on web conferences or video conferences to showcase their new watches. So everyone's making a shift online. Not only the watch brands, I feel like everyone is. And this shows you not every meeting has to be
a face-to-face meeting. Oh, for sure. I think the watchmaking industry is never, they've stuck to the old school traditions, and they've yet to experience the technological advances that a lot of other companies are already experiencing.
Yeah. And I don't know about you, but some after sales service places were letting people bring benches home.
Really?
Equipment and stuff so they can kind of service watches. Yeah. Yeah. Like I had a very adjusted schedule for people at the workshop, right? And then I also kind of set up a clean room environment for my work from home situation. Because,
I can only imagine the insurance issues you'd have if they can do that, no?
Yeah. So the thing is, I wasn't holding whole pieces of watches, but it was more like the movements, stuff that, like the watch and stuff and all that. A lot of the major components were at the safe and in the workshop, were insurance, where we had insurance. And then, that was just servicing the movements. And when it would be done, I would, go back.
Now, is this for every single repair, or is this just for like emergency watches that you need to get out? Like,
ASAP? No, it's just for like stuff that's like pending and stuff that's kind of like rushed. So it wasn't. It's every about day like thing, right? There were like 4 or 5 different workshops. Yeah. It was like a piece here, a piece there. I'm working on a very vintage Fousey chain pocket watch that was clients great great grandfather's. your pocket watch. So I have that with me where I'm slowly working on it, slowly kind of like restoring it back to its former glory.
How did you fare up in the cold COVID situation? Is everything all right with with your company and all that? Did you see an increase or decrease, or was it just the same amount of workload?
there was exponential increase in private clients that sent us work. So people weren't buying new watches, so they were rather restoring and servicing the watches they had. So we saw an increase kind of like from that avenue, and then a decrease in trade work, right? So like the more institutionalized organizations we handle, and you know, a bunch of jewelry companies, they kind of ceased sending work, kind of like overnight. And obviously, yeah, you know, that goes without saying, you know, because you know everything shut down.
Now, do you think that compared to the other industries, okay, do you think that the watchmaking industry got hit hard? Do you think it suffered, or do you think it? Or do you think the watchmaking industry did fairly well considering how much the other industries got impacted?
So I used to be privy to a lot of those sales numbers at a former organization I worked in, but I'm not part of the kind of the sales process or the retail aspect of it. And I'm going on a hunch. I'm going on what I've seen, you know, people do. So I've seen people not spend as much on luxury goods and not spend as much on retail stuff, you know? So, and even if they were buying, they would try to buy it secondhand, or they would buy it and they would negotiate a fit where it was agreed upon. So, I mean, I think the retail sector got hit hard. I feel like, you know, no new watches were being sold, you know, as much. Obviously, you know, tourism stopped as well. So I used to remember working at another boutique where, you know, certain months, you know, would make and break their year cycle,
oh, for sure,
you know, the annual bottom line, because it would be
You broke up there, Henry.
Yeah, it would be tourist season, you know. So that you know, now that tourism's air travel and all that stuff has stopped, I feel like that would impact it dramatically.
Now, compared to other industries, do you think watchmaking got hit hard?
Yeah.
Okay.
Watchmaking, as far as retail, like retail selling.
See, I don't know. I mean, I. This is my opinion, okay? I think the watchmaking went... I'm talking about the industry as a whole, right? I think the industry got... I mean, I'm sure they got hit. Every industry got hit. But what I think is that I don't think the watchmaking industry got hit as hard as all the other industries did, okay? I think as long as there's some sort of hierarchy system in the world where there's the upper class, middle class, and lower class, there's always going to be sales coming in, whether it's through online sales or secondhand sales, pre-owned, vintage, you name it. And I do agree with you that the retail section got hit hard, you know, and tourism went down. So I'm sure globally, purchases of new watch in terms of tourism went down. But I still think that as a whole, that money that they would have spent in tourism for watches and while they're traveling abroad, I think they still spent that sooner or later, whether it's through e-commerce or secondhand watches or pre-owned watches or getting their own watches repaired. I think that money got re-pulled into other facets of watchmaking. I don't know if it watchmaking as a whole got hit as bad as the airline companies, you know what I mean? Or I don't think the watchmaking industry got hit as hard as the industry as a whole.
You see, I don't agree with that. I think everyone got hit hard. Because I mean, when you're not selling, or when you're selling minimal amount of pieces in the 3 months and you're not servicing, like, you're not running to the fullest your capabilities. So, you know, that's almost a quarter, or let's say half year, lost in revenue and productivity, right? So, you know, where a lot of service centers, they weren't open, you know, how does that affect, you know, that's just a backlog of work that it creates, and that's just people not being productive. And obviously, sorry, because I used to work in a after sales service center and meeting KPIs and production and productivity and managing those, you know, was important because that would affect obviously your bottom line, whether you got a bonus or not.
But see, I don't know, like, for example, I know, for example, like what you said, service centers and everything got backlogged, but these companies, you know, in states that have already opened up, they're getting these work done. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, I mean, even though the work got backlogged, the work is still going to get done by the end of the year. So the past couple months or several months due to the lockdown that no one got working, when the states and everything like that opened up, as we've seen already, like, I'm sure these watchmakers, these companies are going to get that return, those watches repaired, you know. And on top of that, when they come back into the full swing of things post-COVID, they have the e-commerce that's already taken off. So I still think that, I mean, I still think that sooner or later, the work's going to get done.
No, I also agree with that, right? Like, but I also agree with the fact that, like, this current predicament or situation the world is in opened up other avenues for a lot of industries, right? So, yeah, obviously this is a good segue into maintaining an online brand presence, right? Because that's, you know, ultimately the shift in the world, right? Everyone went from in-person meetings, flying to meeting people, to just going to the Zoom meetings, right? Like, there was a investment banking thing that they got a bunch of funding. So instead of going on physical road shows, they just went on a Zoom road show.
Yeah. And
they got the funding they needed in like a fraction of the time. Normally it takes a couple weeks on the road, and they got it like within a week.
How did you do? Did you do Zoom with your watchmaker? Did you Zoom with your company and whatnot?
FaceTime. We did FaceTime, and then, you know, we would hop on kind of all hands on deck calls, and yeah, I mean, mostly, you know, I'm trying to, like, you know, we manage everything. I try to manage everything digitally, and then so, you know, Sarah and Destiny, who work for WMP, obviously, they're based out of Atlanta and they help out, you know, remotely. So I've set it up where we can be operational. If, you know, we have a couple of watchmakers on the bench, that it's business as usual.
I mean, I tried using Zoom for like the first week or two and it was going well, but I think there was some sort of, I don't know how accurate this is, but I saw in the news, like, there was a huge privacy issue they had or something like that. Something about your information being sold to, you know, out of the country and whatnot.
No, so they would have hackers Zoom bomb you, right? And that's essentially where a bunch of random people join your Zoom call and kind of, you know, wreak havoc, right? So let's say if you were in an important business meeting, like I was on a call with a small business association in New York, just to get clarification on, you know, the programs and stuff that are currently out there given this current economy, and we were Zoom bomb, right? Like, they were like,
oh crap,
they were throwing like racial slurs, they were saying the N-word, they were saying, you know, Chinese people caused this whole thing, and obviously, you know, that they eventually found them and kicked them off. But, you know, early on, that was an issue, and that I felt like Zoom at that stage wasn't ready for the world to be logged into Zoom, right? Zoom was for sure comfortable with having large corporations kind of pick up their instance and do the video calls that they needed to. But then when schools were doing it, when, you know, a lot of telemedicine, they were getting into it, that opened a whole new vector of attack for them, because believe it or not, like, there are a lot of pedophiles out there who would like to see, you know, kids on the internet, right? Like, they'd like to see kids like jump and like do stuff. And that's why, like, I've, you know, I had a friend of mine who went as congressman when the school asked the student, the daughter of his, to send a video or send a picture of his daughter, his teenage daughter, through this like online platform so that they can confirm like she's doing gym or something. And he's like, heck no.
Oh wow.
Because, you know, that's, yeah, that, I mean, there are a lot of there as much good people as there are in the world, there's equally the same amount of people who want to do other people harm.
Yeah, I transferred from Zoom into Google Meets. I think that was easier for me with my guys. I didn't know that. Wow. Dude.
Yeah, be careful of, you know, who you're letting control or handle your information.
Wow. Shit.
It's important to have, like, you know, your online security in check, because one wrong move and then, you know, that's all they need is that one wrong move and your life is hell.
So did you see any increase in online interactions during the whole COVID situation with your company? Did you see any increase or
of course. I mean, the people would hit me up and chat me and say, like, they have a watch and, you know, like, how should they, you know, get us over the watch? Are we gonna meet in person? And, you know, I told them, obviously, we have there's a UPS storefront where we have kind of a box where if you can drop off your watch and, you know, I'll pick it up, sanitize it, take a picture of it, let you know, like, hey, we have your watch.
Actually, what's your disinfectant procedures? Like, has your take-in process changed since?
Not really. To be honest, I don't. You know, the whole thing of it being highly contagious, like, I just didn't see that, you know. I would obviously when we get the watch in, like, you know, some places are like putting in ultrasonic, some places are like putting on the UV, places aren't touching the watches for like a week or a couple of days or something. You know, like, we still, you know, get the watch in, and, you know, we do like a general wipe down of this case itself.
What do you use to wipe it down? Alcohol?
Just alcohol wipe, you know, like, you know, 75% alcohol wipe, just to clean the watch head so it's not, you know, too filthy. And then I would, you know, the ladies would take pictures and we would send it over to the client to let them know that we have their timepiece.
Now, in terms of your bracelets and in between the crevices or the leather straps, like, how are you sanitizing that?
We don't, right? Like, the straps, we put the straps aside. Obviously, we don't want to put any
you don't want to damage the strap with the alcohol, right?
Yeah, I don't want to damage the strap at all. So we normally put straps aside. If it's a bracelet, then, you know, that can get dumped into the ultrasonic.
Now, the strap and stuff, you just leave it aside for a couple of days?
We take it out and put it into another Ziploc bag and then put it with the job. So it's like, you know, it stays contained while we wipe the watch.
So the funny thing about talking about the take-in process, I had one of my guys actually do some research on ultraviolet. And you know, the rundown essentially was UVA, UVB, and UVC, right? So they say UVC kills the virus, but is the one with the highest amount of harm to the human body. And the funny thing is that in Asia, I think they have buses and trains where they sanitize the entire area, the entire train, the entire bus with the ultraviolet C, and they just flash it. So, I mean, I don't know how the industry might even be going about disinfecting their take-in process or with these watches.
I feel like,
or do you think it's overrated?
I think they should do what they feel comfortable for themselves. So if they want to take it in and, like, not touch the watch for 2 weeks and then open the watch and then feel like it's been safe, that coronavirus has died, then by all means, right? It's like, it's whatever their own comfort level is.
Now, what about the lead times? You know, what about like the due dates? You know, like, a lot of times, like, a lot of these companies are operating under like huge productivity levels, and on top of that, you have to deal with the amount of employees. You know, like, because if someone gets sick from it, you know, it's kind of like a liability right there.
You know, that's a tough one. When we intake watches, you know, obviously we're geared up, right? we're not taking anyone's watches and then sniffing the bracelet and sniffing the watch head. So if someone decides to rub the watch case into their eyeballs and try to get themselves sick, they can sue the company. By all means, that's their prerogative, right? But
I'm picturing a client just like, I'm picturing like a watchmaker just like jamming it into his eyeball, like arm cheese galore.
Yeah, he's gonna collect ETO, like sick days, baby. Here they come. But yeah, I mean, like I said earlier, right? Like whatever makes them feel comfortable, whatever process they like to feel, you know, safe. You know, like I remember from day, like the first day, like during the coronavirus, so you would buy groceries and you would literally leave it in the hallways, wipe every thing down. Shit. And then, like, bring it back in. Now it's just like, oh, whatever, buy it. Like, just like, it's like one wipe across like 18 different purchase lists. And it's like, it's clean.
I was watching videos on, I saw some videos on YouTube or Facebook or something like that where, like, this guy was, I don't know, I think it was OCD level cleaning, but he took in the entire bag, wiped down every single item, cleaned every single item, by the time he was done cleaning his groceries, he probably went through an entire box of Clorox or Lysol wipes or something like that. And I was just like, I don't know if that's even...
You see, a lot of people for the first month, they were doing that. And then the WHO came out and, you know, the World Health Organization came out with like, oh, by the way, it's not as contagious as we think. You know, like it's not as...
I saw this thing about from the World Health Organization. They're saying that asymptomatic carriers are rare. Like the transmission is rare now. Meanwhile, before they were saying it was like a primary form of transmission.
And they also did say, like, if your blood type is O or something, that you have higher immunity to the coronavirus. I mean, listen, they're changing this stuff. Like, not changing it, but, like, there are new updates to this, like, almost every day. And it's getting to the point where, like, a month three, month four, you're kind of, like, beaten to death by COVID-19 news. So it's like, oh, whatever, you know, like, I don't. Like, at this point, as long as I'm doing my part, like, you know, obviously I got tested. I'm in the heart of New York City. Right. And there were concerns, you know, of loved ones I had. And I went to get tested for number one, COVID-19. And then number two, the blood test, which tests for antibodies. And I was negative for both. So
now what was the process? Did it jam like this huge swab up your nose?
Oh, yeah. If you saw, you know, what Cuomo, the governor of New York, went through, pretty much what I went through, they shoved a swab, kind of like it tickles your eyeballs.
It's something you used to, huh?
You know, if we had a visual medium, you would see what finger I'm holding for you right now, Anthony.
Yeah, no, I mean, man, I mean, and now since you're in the heart of New York City, have you seen anyone even practice social distancing anymore? I mean, I've seen videos and I've seen clips of like St. Mark's of everyone just chilling and everyone just walking around almost as if COVID-19 wasn't even an issue.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's been indoors for a better part of 3 to 4 months, right? Like it's hard. I get it, right? Again, just try to maintain distance, and if you can't maintain distance, put the mask on. That's kind of like the unspoken rule in New York City. So like I would walk, you know, to take my morning walks and go here and there, pick stuff up, and it's getting really hot in New York City. So I pull my mask down when there's no one around. When I see someone, I pull my mask back up just so that I'm, you know, reasonable.
Now, do you agree with classifying this as a new normal? Or do you think later on down the line, no one's going to be wearing masks anymore?
You see, I think everyone, this is still fresh, right? There's still like, I don't think the first wave is over, because it's still very much something that people worry about. So I think until we have a working vaccine where people can kind of go get like a flu shot or a coronavirus shot, that it will be, a concern for people, right? And I mean, just look at the Spanish flu, right? When that first came, you know, everyone they were also wearing face masks, right?
Okay. So. Well, Wow. I mean, we've already been 50. We've already been a good, like, an hour in. We'll probably just answer one more question. I mean, there's a bunch of questions still. But we'll answer one more question and then we'll wrap it up. How's it sound? All right. Sounds great. So this next question is one watch. Actually, no, before I even say that, I had done an Instagram poll. If you had to choose one utensil for the rest of your life, one utensil to use for everything you eat, would it be a spoon or a fork?
Neither.
Chopstick. That's cheating. That's cheating. Because a lot of people hit me up with that. And I'm like, no, that doesn't count. If you had to choose between a spoon or a fork, one of the two.
No, no. But you said, but before you preface a spoon, a fork, you said utensil, right? Like,
how are you going to eat?
I'm pretty sure. How are
you going to eat steak with the chopstick?
You want to watch me do it?
That's just cheating, all right?
Hey, Mama Lee taught me well. I don't know about you, Anthony, but yeah.
All right, well, look. Okay, so this guy chose a spoon, okay? The guy who's asking the question, he said he chose a spoon. But anyway, he said one watch for the rest of your life. Which one would it be?
I would... I'm stuck between Audemars Piguet or Jaeger LeCoultre. I might probably do Jaeger.
You would choose AP? Is that even a debate?
I was stuck between an AP. No, I was stuck between an AP and a Jaeger. But yeah, I'd probably be sticking
with JLC. Okay, what watch from JLC?
The Ultra Thin.
Ultra Thin?
Mm-hmm.
The Ultra Thin. Now, what was your choice for AP?
I believe it is a blue dial dual time power reserve.
Royal. Okay, now are we talking about. Now, are you looking at. How are you basing this judgment? Are you basing this off of complication? Or are you basing this off of utility? Like, what are you basing this off of? Service life?
Neither. No, none of that. Like, everything you just mentioned, it was like way too technical for me. I'm basing off of stuff that I like.
So you're just basing off pure interest?
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy that type of thing. Or those timepieces.
You know, I don't. What would you say is the service cost of an AP or the service cost of a JLC?
See, now you're asking AB
because...
-1, AB -2. Hey, buddy, are we slowly just keeping this very high level?
No, you're right. But see, the way I'm basing this off of is, if I had to choose one watch for the rest of my life, I'm basing this off of like an overall holistic
how
approach,
much service
you know
costs.
What I mean? Like, I'm thinking ahead, like, service life, parts availability, you know, is it durable? Can I wear this in any occasion? You know, like, how flexible and versatile it is.
You know, why don't you just get, like, a 2892 or get, like, a 750? Just, like, and then just
because
be done
if
with
that
it.
Was the case...
You obviously don't like the finer things in life.
I don't know. Maybe it's just me, but if I had to choose one watch for the rest of my life, and I'm factoring all these into equation, I think I'd choose a Rolex. Honestly, I mean, not to sound. God, I think that's so cliche, though. I don't want.
That's very Anthony. The answer is very Anthony-esque, and but I can see that. I can see that because you have a fixed cost. There's a certain amount of spare parts for the movements. You guarantee the same product over and over and over again. So yeah, I think that suits that answer suits.
I can't tell if this is a passive aggressive thing or that sounds so passive aggressive.
Passive aggressive.
I mean, you're
never.
You're
I don't know
a
what you're
shy inch
about.
Away from just saying that's a typical response from you. I completely expected that coming from you. That's you're shy. You're like one word shy from saying that.
Hey,
but I.
But
see, look, here's what I'm saying. You can't wear that ultra thin in everything you're going to be doing. You know, like, if I...
want to bet?
You're going to have a broken JLC in no time.
That I can fix.
But what about parts availability? See, that's where I'm coming from. If I'm basing it off of what I can fix, how available the parts are, how versatile, and how often I will have to get a service.
For me right now, I have the parts.
I guess you like to live
maybe
life a little dangerously.
20, 30 years. Listen, I'm one of those guys that, like, I am a little rough. I'm not rough. I won't buy something that I won't wear, that I won't use, right? Like, I like to get utility out of something I purchase, right? So if I bought a watch I wear, I'm going to wear it, right? Whether I'm sweating it, whether, like, I bang it. I'm not going to go do construction in my JLC, obviously. But, like, you know, I'll wear it out. Like, I'll wear it to places. And you know, I won't be scared if a scratch happens or if I bump it. You know, like, I had, you know, a Speedy that, like, I, you know, I hit the door on something by accident and it popped the crystal.
Wait, what? How hard did you was like, hit your Omega? Jeez, that doesn't just happen, dude.
It happens.
What, did you hit the wall? Like, arm out the car or something? What happened there?
No, so, like, you know how you're, you know, running after the door before it closes, and you're like, oh, and you reach for it, and, like, I caught the tip of the door, and and my watch caught the edge of the door.
How fast were you freaking running?
I was maybe a bit enthusiastic that day, so to speak. You know, I might have had a pre-workout or a couple, one too many coffees, and needed to get to where
and
I was going.
And your crystal popped off clean, or did it break?
No, it was acrylic. It popped off clean. And then I just looked at it, a 2-second rule, blew it, and then I was like, oh, my God, it's fine. I put it right back in. And no, wait, so before I even did it, I looked around. Like,
oh, shit.
That? Right, that... Good. I blew it a couple times, and then, like, just slapped it back in. Then yeah.
I think that really suits this podcast, man. Watch making him bullshitting. Jeez. Now, did you fix that right away, or did you send it into the mic, or did you fix it?
Fix what?
The acrylic crystal.
When I put it back in, it stayed.
You just popped it right back in?
Yeah, I pressed it with my palm down, and I looked around. I shook my wrist a little. I was like, all right, like, it's not popping out, right? Now I'm going to make an obvious mental note not to run the watch into a corner.
Oh,
of the door.
Oh, my God. This is like heresy. This is like watchmaking. Don't do this in watchmaking 101.
Hey, listen, I'm trying to keep this non-bullshitty, so it works.
Now I'm going to get...
Why would you want to touch something
that
works?
Watch me get an influx of people DMing me saying that that's exactly what they're going to be doing for the rest of their life.
But listen, I noticed nothing was wrong with timekeeping, right? Like, the watch was still running fine, you know? Like, I obviously hit the crystal clean off and popped off, and I put it back in. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like if I would have jammed the hands, or if I would have seen the visible damage to the dial, then I'm like, all right, cool. I have to, like, take it apart and, like, clean it up and, like, fix it.
Now,
but I mean,
you don't
like
think
I
that
said,
some sort of impact damage occurred to your watch when you hit it at that rate?
Yeah, again, it occurred on the acrylic. The
I don't know
acrylic
if that
crystal.
Speaks more volume about your acrylic crystal or about the rate of your wrist.
Listen, however you want to take this story is on you, right? Because I've told many people who come to me for service, they're like, oh, I just want a service watch. I'm like, well, is it still running? He's like, yeah. Did you drop it? No. When was the last time you serviced it? And they're like, oh, you know, like, we bought the watch brand new. Like, this is like the third or fourth year. Like, we'd like to get it serviced. I'm like, well, you don't notice anything wrong with it.
No, that I agree with.
Like,
that
I mean,
I agree.
I'm not,
but
I'm not trying to take money from you that I'd like to have, obviously. But, like, I'm not trying to do you a disservice by telling you to service something that doesn't need it. And that was the same situation.
I
have.
I don't know if that's the same.
Right? Like,
situation.
After shock damage. After the shock damage, I assessed it, right? I popped it back in, and then I timed it. I assessed it, and it was, like, still running within my tolerance. And I was like, all right, cool.
Now, what's your tolerance?
-1 plus or minus 6.
Okay, that's a standard.
Seconds per day. Yeah, and it was, maybe was running fast 3 seconds, and then it got pushed up to, like, 5 or 6 seconds, right? And then I was like, all right, cool. That's, I'm not, like... I'm not. It's not a big deal, right? I'm not one of these guys that wears a watch, and that watch, like, is, you know, it's not my first baby, so to speak.
You rather
you know
own
I mean?
The watch
so,
than
like,
have
I'm
the
not,
watch on you. I
Yeah. Yeah. And you see that with guys with cars, new watches, and it's just like sad. Like they'll buy it and just dump it into a safe. And they won't get utility out of it. They won't get to wear it and enjoy
what. Well, if you bought, I mean, so. This reminded me of a conversation where they, the, like, if you owned the, you know, a Patek Philippe and it was like one of the world's great, most expensive watches, are you going to be wearing that sucker or are you going to be putting that in a vault?
Oh, have you not listened to anything I said? Like, my 20 minutes.
No, I'm being that serious. Like, so if you have a, like, one of the world's most expensive Patek Philippe, you'd still just wear it around and just be like, yeah.
I don't give a, like, that doesn't, if I bought it to wear it, I'm going to wear it. But if I bought it to, like, let's say, hey, as investment, this will go up. Like, yeah. Let me put it in safe and then sell it 10 years down the line. That's a different story. Right, like that. If I go to Sotheby's or Phillips auction house and I pick up something, and the goal of that intention,
okay,
the intent. Goal of that, again, and intention of that was to buy it as an investment, then yes, right. But like, I won't buy a watch as an investment if I'm not going to wear it. Like you know, like I'm my goal is to buy a watch and enjoy the shit out of the watch, because I also am a watch geek when it comes to like watches, right? Like I enjoy a nice looking clean timepiece on your wrist.
Okay. Well, I think this is a good time to end the podcast here. I think, what do you think? I think we've answered a good amount of questions. I think we can keep doing, we can answer the next questions in the next episode. But we have a bunch left. I think we covered a good deal. All right. Well, for those of you guys who don't know who Henry is, Henry, again, is the owner of Watchmaking Project. If you guys need any watches serviced, you can hit him up. Henry, what's your website again? Watchmakingproject.com?
Yes. And thank you for the shameless plug. I try not to.
I mean, I want to, I mean, towards the end of this, I mean, you still want to promote something, right? You want to have your name out there. I mean, you guys already know Henry's personality.
Thank you.
Through this podcast. And you know he's not going to take your money if you don't need it, but he'll also smash his Omega into the wall.
If that's the only thing you got out of my entire story, sure. While you're at it, please be sure to not rub a watch case.
Yes. If it's COVID and infected, please don't do that. But other than that, guys, take care, and hope you guys enjoyed the podcast.
All right, thank you. Stay safe, everyone. Hugs and kisses. Cheers.